too much detail on all of the programs right now, but know that the outline will go into that. If you care for it, I'll provide that at a later time. This first bill concentrates on a small problem in the law that has to do with the active versus inactive license. An active license is a contractor's license authorizes them to do work in Oregon. It begs the question of, well, why would a contractor want to put their license in an inactive status? And of course, the reason for that is the licensing requirement that requires the testing. And many contractors take the test. They prefer to hold on to that ability to perform work at a later time, and they want to put their license in an inactive status. The statute currently talks about a two-year period, and there is no definition of that two-year period. So from time to time, we have contractors wondering, well, can I put that license in an inactive status and go back into an active status in two calendar years? What about two fiscal years? And, of course, we believe it was the intent of the Assembly to make that the two-year license period. This bill would put that in stone. We believe there's no controversy on this matter. I've had nobody who suggested that this is an improper interpretation, and we would ask your support.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to find myself in that position in February when my renewal comes up, because being a small contractor, I can't carry my work around in a briefcase, and my wife doesn't want me to pay liability unless I am making some money. My question is, the industry, are the contractors in support of this idea, or is there, have you heard any pushback, feedback? I'm looking out there at them right now. Is this, are they all supportive of this kind of idea? Personally, I have no problem with it.
Well, Chair Brown and Representative Schaffler, what I can tell you is I can't speak for the industry, obviously.
Right.
But we've worked with the industry regarding these matters. I've had no conversation from any of the industry lobbyists to suggest pushback on this concept.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Is there any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is whether how long you can stay in inactive status.
Okay. Chair Brown and staff, we do not have a time limit on that, so it could be forever.
Mr. Chair, one comment. My wife's glad to hear that, so if I lose an election, I can go back to work. And thank you.
Mr. Roy, did you have?
No, not on this one.
Okay. Representative Holden.
Just a question in regards to reactivating a license. If it's been an extremely long period of time, is there any provisions for retesting the contractors at that point?
No.
Chair Brown and Representative Holvey, currently there are no provisions to require additional testing or education requirement.
Representative Esquivel.
I guess my question would be a follow-up to Representative Holvey. Why not?
Well, that's a good question, Chair Brown, Representative Esquivel.
Because things change, you may have an inactivated license for 6 years or 8 years or whatever. Things change. Laws change. Criteria changes.
Concrete changes.
Chair Brown, Representative Esquivel, there is no continuing education requirement. We have discussions with the industry about that. Although I haven't discussed this with the board recently, continuing education for contractors has not been a high priority for this current board. We talk about it from time to time. At some point, I think the industry will support it. Currently, we don't have that kind of support.
Any other questions? That was all the...
Yeah.
Okay. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on House Bill 2074? If not, we'll close the public hearing on 2074. And open a work session on House Bill 2074.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
I would move to accept House Bill 2074, move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2074 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative Escalante.
Yay.
Representative Gilman. Representative
Excuse.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Cockburn.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Aye.
This is
so I asked for. Is there any objection to Representative Gilman voting on House Bill 2074?
No.
Seeing none, Representative Gilman, how do you vote on House Bill 2074?
Aye.
Wrong answer.
You're the only one.
We need a motion carries. We need a carrier for House Bill 2074, and brings Representative Gilman was last to come in. And would you care to carry the bill?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't hear you.
By design? Or
just say yay.
Would you like to carry the bill on the House floor?
Yes.
Representing Gilman will carry the bill. Let's see. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2071. And we've got three same gentlemen again.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. One of the most unique parts of the state of Oregon's method for holding contractors accountable for their business practices is its dispute resolution program. It's similar to some other states, but it has some special parts to it that really make it shine. Seated to my left is Bill Boyd. Bill has been shepherding that program now for a number of years. Bill is a practicing attorney. We try not to hold that against him. He's also an engineer and very skilled in mediation. Bill's going to give you an overview of the dispute resolution program and talk to you about this bill.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, the dispute resolution program is designed.
Bill, could I get you to give us a
closer
name and address for the record?
My name is William J. Boyd. I'm the dispute resolution manager, program manager for the Construction Contractors Board.
Thank you.
The dispute resolution section handles disputes between contractors and their customers, other contractors and material suppliers, and employees. So they do very much the same work that a court of law does. In effect, this program is an alternative method for people who deal with contractors to resolve their dispute. Generally, it's a cheaper method because they don't have to hire an attorney. If they do hire an attorney, the attorney would spend less time with the process. And unlike the court system, there's some other parts of this program which you just can't get at a court of law. For instance, if we have an investigation and we recommend that a contractor do repairs, the contractor actually has a right to do those repairs, which you'll never get at a court of law. Usually in a court of law, it's the issue is damages. Also, we meet the parties in a residential claim out on the job site, and I'll be going through that, but I just wanted to point out some of the unique aspects of our program. The beginning of a claim starts with a notice to the contractor, which must be sent by certified mail to the contractor's address of record, and that needs to be sent 30 days before the claim is filed. Once that 30 days runs, then a party can file a claim with the CCB. Now, they do that in one of two ways, depending on the type of structure involved in the claim. If it's a residential structure or a small commercial structure, they can file that claim by submitting a statement of claim to the board. If it's a large commercial structure, it's a little more complicated, and I'll cover that in a few minutes. We also have some time limitations for filing a claim. the time limitations aren't subject to any of the legislation you're going to see today, but just briefly, the claim must be filed within 1 year of occupancy of a new structure or 1 year of after substantial completion of work on an existing structure. That's stricter than the court system, by the way, and I think that when your constituents give you a call, that's more often than not going to be one of the topics they're going to bring up. But remember, they do have the court system available, which has longer limitations. The reason that that time limitation is so strict is because it affects the cost of the bond that some 40,000 contractors have to get in order to be licensed. And they have to pay a yearly premium to a bonding company. And 90% of those contractors will never have a claim against them. So that time limitation can have a big economic effect. The residential claims process, as I said, deals with is if you have a building that's either a residence or a small commercial structure, you file a statement of claim with a CCB. We make a preliminary determination as to whether we have jurisdiction or not, and if we do have jurisdiction, we request that you pay a $50 filing fee. Or I'm sorry, not a filing fee, a processing fee. Then we schedule it, if it's a residence and it's an owner claim, we schedule it for a what's we call an on-site investigation, and that involves sending one of our investigators out to meet the parties at the home site or the small commercial structure. And the first thing that the investigator tries to do is to see if a settlement can be reached. And we get settlements in a large number of our claims. However, not all of those settlements are complied with. So we dispose of about some a third of our claims by way of settlement. If we can't reach a settlement, then the investigator determines whether the work is defective or not. And if it is defective, recommends the repairs, and the contractor is given a short time to schedule and complete those repairs. If the work is not defective, then the recommendation is that the claim be dismissed. If we tell the contractor to do repairs and the contractor doesn't do those, or if the contractor agrees to do the repairs in a settlement and doesn't complete the repairs, then we ask the claimant to go get bids from licensed contractors to do those repairs. And those are all submitted to us, and our claims examiner reviews the file to determine whether there's enough evidence in the file to issue what we call a proposed order. Now, that order can be to dismiss the claim, or it can be that the contractor pay damages. Each party has 21 days to request a hearing, and if they do request a hearing, then we will send that to the Office of Administrative Hearings for either a hearing under arbitration rules or a hearing under administrative law rules, which are also called contested case rules. So that's the process, and I'll cover the hearing just a little bit more. And by the way, I'm probably on the second page of our program review, which is page 6. Now, the large commercial claim is different. In a large commercial claim, the claimant must file the claim in court and then send us a copy of that complaint, and also send a copy to the bonding company for the contractor, so that if the bonding company wants to join in the court action to contest that, the bonding company can do so. We don't require a processing fee because we don't do much processing on these claims. The court determines all of the substantive issues. And then after the court issues its judgment, and if the judgment is in favor of the claimant, then we determine how much of that judgment is within our jurisdiction. And we issue, again, a proposed order with that determination, and each side, if they want to contest that, can request a hearing. Hearings are done, as I said, under either arbitration rules or under administrative law rules. The administrative law system is really designed for enforcement actions where the state is going to take away somebody's license or going to fine them. It's not as well adapted for these two-party cases where the state isn't really doing anything other than acting as a neutral decision maker, and the two parties are in there in front of the administrative law judge slugging it out. So some years ago, we asked the legislature if we could send, if we could use arbitration rules to resolve these things, and that program has been quite successful. I would note that an arbitration ruling is it's very difficult to appeal an arbitration. The grounds for appeal are much narrower than for a contested case ruling. But it also, in arbitration, if the arbiter is presented with imperfect evidence of damages, the arbiter can still make an award, where in many cases, in a contested case, the arbiter would have to either award nothing or possibly award a very overly inflated damage estimate that came from claimant. And so that's one of the reasons we use this process. When the hearing result is done, or if nobody requests a hearing, when we have a final order, then the contractor has 30 days to pay that order, and if the contractor doesn't do so, then we can send it to the contractor's surety company, and the bond company will go ahead and pay up to the amount of the bond, which is, for general contractors, is $15,000. So that's the overview of the program. Is there any questions from the committee before I go into the particulars of 2071?
As going through this process, if you're a homeowner and you file a claim, are you required to be represented by an attorney? Or?
No, you're not. And it's, I would say that the majority of homeowners don't have an attorney there. Sometimes if it goes all the way to a hearing, and then at that point they'll hire an attorney, but most homeowners and most contractors don't have an attorney. And most of these issues, many of these issues, are relatively, you know, there's three or four issues, although in the last several years it seems like we've noticed that the amount that they're asking for has shot up. The claims are getting more complicated, but still we also see a lot of the single issue, you know, the floor squeaks, or the paint job didn't cover well enough, or the roof leaks, those kinds of issues, there isn't so much of a legal issue there. It's just who's responsible for the thing not functioning the way it was supposed to.
Any questions? Don't see any.
Okay, so HB 2071 is just trying to take care of a small problem that we have with the large commercial claims process. As I mentioned, this process begins with a court filing, and then we get a copy of the complaint. The problem is that the complaints often don't have sufficient information to determine whether we have jurisdiction, and they also often lack the necessary information for the bonding company to determine whether its bond is the one that's involved. Their bonds cover a certain period of time, and they aren't sure sometimes as to whether, you know, when the work was completed or when it started, and there's often information that's lacking sometimes as to the exact identity of the contractor. There's a whole host of information that we would like to see that we don't often see in complaints. And so what we're asking with this bill is that at the same time that a party files their complaint by sending us a copy of the court complaint, that they send us a statement of claim, which would provide us the necessary information and the bonding company the necessary information they need to make these determinations. We eventually get that information during the claims process, but the bonding companies need it sooner because they have to make a decision within 30 days as to whether they're going to assert that the party has filed against the wrong bonding company. And so it's but in any case, because we have to sometimes wait for that information, it delays the processing of the claim, and so this bill is to take care of that.
Thank you, Representative Holley.
Can you explain to me why this process should be any different for commercial structures as opposed to residential structures?
Chair Brown, Representative Holby, it's historical, I think, the reason. We actually have another bill which is not before you today, in which we're talking to the industry about, that would make all of the claims process be handled much the same as the residential claims process. But we apparently have some details that they would like us to look at, and so that's not before you. But we would like to change that. I would very much like to change that, because it's tremendously confusing to claimants, and it's confusing to contractors, and it just is. I don't see any particular reason why it shouldn't be one system. But at any rate, that's the status of our claims process today. It developed for historical reasons, which I don't know have much validity today. And it's been this way for, well, I think since 89, somewhere around in there when we went from being a builder's board to being a construction contractor's board.
Chair Brown, I could add a little bit of institutional knowledge there. In 89, from 71 until 1989, this agency was known as the Builders Board. It was just residential construction. When the switch was made to add commercial contractors, it's my understanding that that commercial contractors may not have been comfortable with people who were experts perhaps at residential construction making decisions on what could be considered to be complex commercial structures. And so we're warming them up, we're improving our skills, we think we're there, and we're having a discussion with that industry to see if they're interested in us providing that service.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilman.
If you're going to make this change, do you even need this bill?
The bill is here. I'm sorry, Chair Brown, Representative Gilman. This bill was put in just in case we didn't get the other bill, and as we expected, we have run into some resistance from the industry on the other bill, and you may never see it.
Any other questions? Jim, did you have any testimony? Is there anyone else here that wants to testify on House Bill 2071? And then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2071 and open the work session on House Bill 2071. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move the committee votes on 2071 in affirmative and refer to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2071 to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Gilman.
No.
Representative Colby.
No.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative
Basketball.
Thank you.
Aye. Motion, having received a majority of the motion, passes. We'll need a carrier on the floor.
Mr. Chair, I would move we place it on the consent calendar.
Cannot do that. Have to have a unanimous vote.
Oh, committee. Then I would not move that we place it on the consent calendar. Just testing you.
Mr. Chair, I would volunteer Representative Kitts.
I'll second that.
Representative Kitts, would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
Bold move, Maverick. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Representative. Let's see, which one we have to do? Okay, I want to open a public hearing on House Bill 2072. And, Janet, can you... I won't deny you an opportunity to do your job this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2072, another measure from the Construction Contractors Board, would authorize the board to determine how a party may go about withdrawing a request for a contested case hearing, including a time period for notice of such withdrawal. There's also, if you'll notice in the bill, several sections of law that are just rearranged, but that's the substantive change, is the method of going about withdrawing from a contested case hearing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Start with you, Craig.
Thank you. Chair Brown, members of the committee, this is a fairly small change essentially having to do with housekeeping. I'm going to let Bill Boyd explain to you the nuances of this housekeeping measure.
Chair Brown, this bill is, as I mentioned, we have two procedures for taking a hearing, and one of them involves arbitration rules and the other involves contested case rules. When we wrote the arbitration statute, we wrote into that statute a time limitation for filing the claim in court. In our process, any party at any time can file an action in court, and if they do that in involving the same issues that are in part of the claim, then we suspend processing and allow the court to make their judgment, and then we resume processing based on the judgment after the court makes its judgment. What happens in a hearing sometimes is that a party, and it's usually the contractor, waits until a few days before the hearing. This is historical what had happened, and then files the claim in court, and as a result, we have to suspend processing, and it's extremely frustrating for the other party that they've got all the way up to a few days before the hearing, and suddenly they're having to looking at another 6 months or more delay while the matter gets resolved in court. And we just think that it's really, if you're going to do this, you should do it sooner than later. And so when we did the arbitration statute, we set it up so that after you receive notice of the scheduling of the arbitration hearing, then you have 30 days to make your decision as to whether you're going to file it in court, and if you do, then we will go ahead and suspend processing. But if you wait longer than that, you don't get your court filing, and we're going to go ahead and decide the case through our process. As a result of maybe a little inattention on my part, since I was the one that drafted those changes, we didn't we left a loophole for the contested case hearings, and about 6 months after that law went into effect, we had a contested case going forward, and a party filed in court, and we discovered we couldn't stop them, and they filed in court just a few days before the contested case hearing. What this bill does is it closes that loophole and allows us to write rules that would cut that or allow us to establish that time limitation.
Any questions of Bill? Craig, did you?
No, sir.
So this would not put into statute a particular time limit. It would allow the board the leeway to set that?
Chair Brown, Representative Shields, yes, that's the way that we've set this up. We've learned that sometimes we put things into statute, and you only get one chance every 2 years, and then you write it in, and then you discover that you haven't quite done it right, and then you're back to the legislature in a couple of years. If for these matters that are pretty straightforward, it works best if we can just do a rule so that we can get it right.
Yeah, Janet.
I just wanted to point out to the committee that the substantive change is on lines 12 to 14 of the first page of the bill, because it looks like all new language, but it's actually rearranged. But those are the substantive changes. Is that correct?
Thank you, Janet. We have one other person who wants to testify, and Stephen Kafari, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Committee. My name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here this morning representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. The Oregon Remodelers Association is an organization. We have several chapters statewide representing the remodeling industry. Members include contractors, subcontractors, and suppliers. We were very helpful in the initiation of the original Builders Board and then the change to the Construction Contractors Board. If you may wonder why an organization wants to have regulation and why it pushes for government regulation, oftentimes you hear people say you want less of it, but sometimes good regulation can be helpful for an industry. For most Oregonians, the biggest investment they'll ever make is their home, and it's not only an investment, it's an emotional commitment that people have to the place where they live. There's enormous, unfortunately, potential for abuse when people get into repairing their homes, which a lot of people do over the lifetime of they're living in a house. And because it's expensive to buy a house in the first place, expensive to repair it, oftentimes people look for the cheapest remodeling contractor that can do the job and save them some money. The problem is that one way that, that some contractors save money so they can make low bids is to skirt around the rules by not becoming licensed in the first place, by not paying their workers' compensation, those kind of things, not following the laws. Those members of our organizations who do follow the laws, do follow the regulations, the good guys in this industry, find themselves at a competitive disadvantage if there are those people out there who are not complying by the laws. And so it's to our advantage as well as to the homeowners if we have strict regulations and make sure that all remodeling contractors are following the same rules, and that this benefits the homeowners and it benefits us. We have, since the origin of the Construction Contractors Board, worked very, very closely with them. After the board decides an initial cut on bills that they would like to introduce to the legislature, they have a regular meeting of stakeholders, of which we are one. And we come to those meetings along with other people and discuss whether we think those ideas that the board has proposed are workable or not, whether the industry thinks they'd be helpful or not. And our relationship with the Construction Contractors Board has been very, very good along those lines, so that generally speaking, when they bring a bill to the legislature, you can be sure that the industry has been represented in the discussions moving that forward and it would be supportive. Therefore, I would like not to take your time this morning to come back up and back up and back up on all these bills. I would like to say that we are supportive of House Bill 2072, 2073, 2074, and 2078, essentially all the bills you have with you this morning, with the exception of 2071, and that is because that does deals with commercial contracting, and we don't have commercial contractors or other organizations that represent those folks. So in the relationship to all the bills that deal with residential contracting, we are supportive of bills and would hope that you would pass those.
Thank you, Stephen. Any questions? Seeing none.
Thanks.
Thank you. Is anyone else wants to testify on House Bill 2072? And none. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2072 and open the work session on House Bill 2072. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2072 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2072 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, can you call the roll?
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Esposito.
Aye.
Representative Gilman. Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. We could put this on the consent calendar with motion.
I would, Mr. Chair, I would move that we put 2072 on the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves we place House Bill 2072 on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's done. Okay, we're now opening a public hearing on House Bill 2073. And Janet, can you give us a...
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2073 would authorize the Construction Contractors Board to waive their claim processing fee for all claimants furnishing labor to contractors if the board decides that a majority of the claimants are eligible for fee waivers based on their inability to pay. And this bill also makes some rearrangements to current law. Mr. Chair, I was going to point out again where the substantive part of the bill is. And it's on page 2, the bold language, starting on lines 37 to 41. And if you... And if you also look up at lines 32 to 36, that's the ability of the board currently to waive or defer all or part of the processing fee if you're unable to pay. So you can see the process someone would have to go through to get a waiver, and then the ability, new ability if a bill passes, to waive all claims processing fees for those particular claimants. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Which one starts this time?
I'll start it out, sir.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, in keeping with the concept that the major purpose of the agency is consumer protection, but also holding contractors accountable for their business practices, you've given us statutory authority to receive claims from not just homeowners, but business-to-business type claims, in other words, sub against general, general against sub, and laborers against general contractors. From time to time, general contractors, and this is not often, but from time to time, for various reasons, laborers aren't paid. And the agency holds the surety bond, which is the insurance policy, if you will, for making sure the contractors keep their promises to Oregonians. And so we're able to take what we call employee claims. Don't receive a lot of them, but they're an effective way for someone who hasn't been paid to encourage the contractor to pay their debts. Because if we determine that the money hasn't been paid, we'll, of course, take the license away if the contractor doesn't make that payment, and we'll go after the bond. So to explain what the problem's been here, Bill Boyd will talk a little bit about our employee claims.
Bill? Chair Brown, the problem is that you're a typical employee. Some of them are quite educated and they're very skilled, but we also have a class of employees who are very uneducated and very unskilled. They're basically laborers, and they're working for minimum wage. They already have trouble filing a claim with us because the claims forms ask for a lot of information that confuses them. And then on top of that, they may be in very economically disadvantaged and find it very difficult to come up with the $50 processing fee when we ask them for it. We have a form that they would have to fill out in order to ask for a waiver of that fee. We've only had one homeowner request a waiver since we started this program. I think it's because most people that are filing a claim, if they own a home, they can come up with $50. But we've had a drop-off on the number of employee claims, and we suspect that this $50 and the whole complexity of the process may make it difficult for them to file the claim. Now, so this bill is designed to give us authority to waive that fee for all employee claims if we find that a majority of those claimants would be eligible for the $50 waiver. We have not developed the evidence to support that yet, and today, if we had that authority, we would not be adopting a rule to that effect because we can't show that. But if we do develop that evidence in the future, that would be the where we would this law would kick in.
Bill, Representative Schomper,
yeah, and I appreciate waiving $50 for a poor laborer because I am one anyway. But How are the laborers going to know about this? How are we going to get this information out to them? That's really concerned about.
If we represent Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, I have to get used to this system of addressing the committee every 2 years, and it's a little uncomfortable at first. We would just change when a person wishes to file a claim, they get about a 20-page manual that describes the whole process and also describes, you know, line by line what they need to do. And if there was a waiver, if we had a blanket waiver for all employee claims, it would just indicate that we would not be collecting or asking for the $50 if it was an employee claim. Right now, we do indicate that there is the $50 processing fee that's asked for after you file your claim, and it indicates that they can request a waiver, but they would have to ask for the forms and so on. And so, I think most people, when they file their claim, they do get our entire booklet either sent to them by mail or they download it from the web.
I'll go to Representative Esquivel first.
I think Representative Kitts was ahead of me.
But I'll defer the Honorable
okay,
Vice Chairman.
Why don't I ask my question then? Is there any concern about frivolous claims?
Chair Brown, that was in fact one of the reasons that we asked the legislature to create a processing fee was to reduce frivolous claims. But we do have a process for winnowing those things out. I mean, you just can't make the claim. You have to show with some sort of documentary evidence, or if necessary, if people don't have the documents, then we would send it over for a hearing where they would have to go in and testify, and then it's going to be a determination by the administrative law judge as to which party is telling the truth. So we do have a way of avoiding frivolous claims. The $50 processing fee was in part to avoid those being filed at all, you know, to get rid of them from the get-go. And in fact, we have had a significant drop-off on the number of claims we received, so I think that it's probably working. But yes, if there was no processing fee, that there would be a possibility that an employee could make a frivolous
thank
claim.
You, Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a several layered questions. So, first of all, if I might, how does someone verify to you that they are unable to afford it to obtain this waiver?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, the form that we have is the rule actually is tied to the information that to the federal guidelines for poverty, to the federal poverty guidelines, and we ask them a bunch of questions like, you know, do they own their home, how much rent are they paying, how much income do they get, and so on, and that is a public record, which we, when they send that to us, we would send it to the contractor, and if the contractor has any knowledge that information isn't given truthfully, then we would expect to get a response from the contractor.
So after the Spanish Inquisition of their personal finances, am I to assume that, so you can come back and go one of two ways, either yes, you deserve a waiver because you've verified to us that you can't afford it, or no, you can afford the $50 because you make too much money. So that's, mm-hmm. Is that fair to assume?
Representative Brown, Representative Kitts, yes.
Why then would you not change the policy to go after, why is it up to me to pay money to try to obtain wages that are owed me? Why not make it the policy of the Construction Contractors Board that says that if in fact I come forward and I assert that my employer has wronged me and pass the bill along to the employer, make them liable for your time because it's as a result of them not doing what they were supposed to do in the first place that made me have to bare my soul and my financial records to perfect strangers that I don't even know to obtain a waiver. Just simply get what's mine.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, in fact, if you do prevail in your claim, and this is the case for all claimants, if they prevail, they get their we include the $50 fee as part of the damages. So they do get that money back if they prevail.
Would you think that, and I appreciate that, follow up please, if I might?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, I didn't want to just go on a diatribe here. I appreciate that. So that being said, wouldn't you think that, I mean, listen, I would much rather pay the $50 even if I couldn't afford it then tell three perfect strangers or whomever I have to interview with my entire financial history, because quite frankly I don't think it's any of your business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I've been wronged. Do your job. Don't worry about my personal finances. That's how I look at it. And so I think that would be more of a deterrent, knowing that I have to come before perfect strangers and pour out my whole financial soul in hopes to obtain a waiver, because if I am making minimum wage and you want to figure out what minimum wage is times an 8-hour workday after taxes, it doesn't even equal $50. So I would rather see the policy of the Construction Contractors Board change. This is, I don't have to. If I've been wrong, I've been wrong. Do your job. Frivolous, who are you or anybody else to determine what is frivolous? Because what's frivolous to me at $1,283 a month that I make may not be frivolous to some guy that's sitting
in Trump Towers. And I know that's an extreme comparison, but I've got a real problem. And I think the way that it's written, Mr. Chair, just to serve notice, I'm inclined to vote no just for those reasons on this. And I would rather see the policy change to say, if you've been wrong, come forward to us, and we are here to help you, not either pay $50 or bear out your whole financial soul. I guess that's my question at the end, so I apologize.
I agree with my colleague, except that if you come forth and you have no stake in this matter, then it would be a lot simpler just to come forth. What happens to the people that come forth that have not a leg to stand on? And yet your employer or whomever ends up putting out monies towards this individual for an unsubstantiated claim. So it's a double-edged sword. But what I want to ask you is, why isn't this under the domain of the Bureau of Labor in the state of Oregon?
Chair
Brown, that's a freebie.
But let me, if I could, address both of these issues. First, today, as the law is written, the situation is, as Representative Kitt suggests, that it's the obligation is on the part of the laborer to try to prove that they don't have enough money. That's one of the reasons we offer this bill, is that just doesn't seem quite right. I don't think the board's taking a position on that, but I understand exactly what you're saying. And if we were able to get this bill through, perhaps even with an amendment, I need to talk to the agents or to the industry. We'd be able to dispose of that $50 fee for all employee claims. That's what this bill does. You know, I served as hearings officer for about 10 years for the Builders Board and the Construction Contractors Board. I never received in hearing a frivolous labor claim. I saw a lot of frivolous claims, but normally they don't come from laborers. When they come from laborers, it's because they were did wrong. And if we can get to the point of a law where laborers aren't charged this processing fee, I don't think it would be a burden on business. That said, it's not a discussion we've had with the industry, and perhaps we could have that discussion.
Bureau of Labor. Why are we handling this when the Bureau of Labor is in place to handle this situation?
Representative Brown, Chair Brown, Representative Esquivel, it's a very good question. In years past, we've worked with Bureau of Labor. 15 years ago, we had it set up so Bureau of Labor would come in and actually process. Well, the short answer is because we hold the bond and we also hold the license. And the ability to hold the contractor liable for those bad behaviors is with us. Bureau of Labor can do what they do, which is good, but we can take that license away in a heartbeat if it's proven that money's owed. We have the funds to do these dispute resolution hearings. We have the interest to do it. And quite frankly, although we work closely with labor, it seems to work just fine for them to refer those kind of complaints to us and let them go through the process very, very quickly and then get that money to that unpaid worker. In terms of volume, I want to say about 20 or 30 a quarter. We don't see a lot of these types of claims. We see a fair amount of them. And, of course, it puts an undue labor or undue burden on the part of the businesses that play by the rules and pay their workers. Because they're bidding on the same projects. So the good guys out there, the folks from home builders, the folks from remodelers, they want contractors who don't pay their bills held to task.
Representing Hovland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your explanation of all these, and I share Representative Kitt's concern about, you know, employees having the money up front to go this route, but understand they can get it back, which is a great thing, or have it waived if they do prove their finances are inadequate. But my question is somewhat unrelated. I'd like to, just for clarification, that in the way this bill reads for claimants furnishing labor, I understand it's aimed at employees, but would a contractor who specializes in just supplying labor
or as a labor broker or something also be eligible for this waiver, or are they subject to the same review of their finances?
Just a second. Let me.
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, if it's a subcontractor, that would be a subcontractor claim, and that falls under a little different set of rules. An employee claim is for an individual who is supplying labor, but if they're a company like you're talking about, somebody who provides in a labor only contract or subcontract, it's going to be a contractor claim.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to see just a little bit more explicit wording in that Section C part, because it says that all claims that are based on furnishing labor by a claimant. And to me, that somewhat takes in that group of labor brokers and labor contractors. So I don't know if you do that by calling it employee claim or whatnot, but it does seem a little ambiguous. It makes me wonder and almost infers that perhaps a labor broker or contractor is also eligible for this waiver of claim, but I rest assured that your board has the wisdom to know their finances wouldn't probably allow them to do this, but I'd just like to see that be a little more specified.
Did you have a question now, Representative Escobar?
No, actually, it's been kind of addressed. I do want to say one thing, though, that's pretty interesting, that, you know, if people did what's right, we'd never have to make a law.
Yeah, that would be a great world for that.
Let me know if you find
it. It would seem to me that for the employee to have this ability to also to waive the fee, have a means of waiving the fee, and to tap and maybe possibly tap this bond, the contractor's bond, to get payment for what's owed him, is just a double-edged sword. He can go to the Bureau of Labor, but they can also go this route here. And if you got two clubs, I'm saying it worked a heck of a lot better than one club to me. Is there any other questions?
Yes, one more question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm not an attorney, so maybe you can help me understand exactly. I understand the importance for you to have the possibility to waive the claim, but what you're saying, and jump in if I'm on the wrong path, is that once the board determines that a majority of the claimants will not meet the requirements to pay do not have the capacity to pay the fee, then you will waive the fee for everybody in the future?
Chair Brown, Representative Shields, that's the intent, would be that we would just do a blanket waiver for employee claims.
Okay. So everybody, after that point, that you made that determination,
right,
wouldn't have to pay the $50 fee.
That's right.
And they wouldn't have to bear their financial dealings as well.
Yeah.
Representative Gibbs.
Forgive me. Can you point me to the section where it says that? I'm trying to, or is that just the intent?
I believe that's what Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, I believe that's what the bill has. I need a copy of the bill and just crazy for getting one. Oh, here we go.
As we look that up, that's what we asked for. Okay, we'll double check it and make sure the language is such, but that's exactly the intent of our legislative concept, was to be able to have a blanket waiver for all employee claims from here on out, once we've developed evidence that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to be asking for financial statements, because most of these type of people don't have the wherewithal to come up with the money. That's the intent. We'll double check the language.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, on page 2 of the bill, starting in the middle of line 38, it says the board may provide for processing fee waiver under this paragraph only if, in the opinion of the board, a majority of the claimants who file claims based on furnishing labor to contractors are eligible for fee waivers as described in paragraph B, which is the part that lays out that the person can the eligibility requirements for a fee waiver.
Janet, you had a question?
Well, one comment, Mr. Chair. People are concerned about the fiscal impact of the bill. The Legislative Fiscal Office and the agency have determined that it's a minimal fiscal impact, so you won't be receiving a fiscal impact statement from the Legislative Fiscal Office, but the agency may be able to speak to that, too. But then I also...
May.
So this would be based on the claims that you're getting now with people paying the fee. So those people may be self-selecting that they can afford it more than people who are not filing with you because they can't afford it. So just a comment, I guess.
Again, Chair Brown and members of the committee, it's our belief that right now there's cold water being poured on labor claims because we got the fee and we have the notice requirement. We believe that because we're getting fewer. Now, it could be that more contractors are paying the bill. That's possible, too. But in these tough economic times, we think that maybe the notice and the fee has poured cold water on these very crucial types of claims. We believe that we'd be able to come up with evidence that would show that these types of claimants don't have the wherewithal to pay for this $50 fee and be able to waive them from that point further forever. That's the purpose.
Everything they're saying, you don't want them to do. This
Representative Schaffler, I almost forgot.
That's okay. I haven't forgotten, unfortunately.
Not overlooked.
If we don't do this, we'll still have a $50 fee. And then some poor laborer ain't going to be able to get a file claim about $50. And what it's saying is it says you may create rules, which means we're going to authorize you to do that, but not require you to at this time. Can you tell me the political makeup of the board, if this passes out, the governor signs it, will you all go right ahead and make rules that will allow to waive the $50 fee if you were going to vote on it today?
If we vote on it, it appears at this time here. And what we want to do is take a look and say, not just do it on because it's, mm-hmm. it's good. Right. Correct only. But it appears that probably this is the case. If it occurs that this is the case, I'm speaking for eight other members who are, mm-hmm. have the vote, of course. I would anticipate they would say yes, waive it for all employees. Mm-hmm. And that's as much as I could, the far out on the limb as I can go right now.
Thank you very much.
Any other question? I sort of lost track. You, gentlemen, through your testimony now.
Yes, sir.
Okay, is there any questions with these guys? Thank you very much. Ed, you look like you might want to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Good morning. I am Ed Glad, and I represent the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, an organization that represents about 5,000 carpenters throughout the state of Oregon, and am associated with the United Brotherhood of Carpenters that represents probably 30,000 members in the sawmills, in the construction industry, and in the paper business here in the state of Oregon. We are willing to support this bill on the purpose that ultimately the changing face of our industry is showing that there are a number of people who come into the state of Oregon and participate in the construction business that do not understand our language and or the capacities of what our governmental system does to regulate the construction industry. When it happens that there is somebody who does not understand entirely what his rights and responsibilities are, and he appeals to or she appeals to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and they process a claim in order to recover lost wages or wages that were inappropriately paid to the laborer, that doesn't necessarily cross over to the construction contractor's board. By the laborer also filing at the construction contractor's board, we create a system, or we create a paper trail, essentially, that the construction contractor's board is able to say, yeah, there has been a complaint against X contractor, or there's been a series of complaints against the X contractor, or the, you know, not X contractor, but contractor X. And so we support the laborer's opportunity to make that claim, and that the claim impacts not just the recovery of his wages, but the ability for that contractor to work freely in the state of Oregon if, in fact, he shows a pattern of neglect towards his obligations to the laborer.
Thank you, Ed. Questions? Representative Esquivel.
So what we're saying here, and you can correct me if I'm wrong out there, but we have a possibility of an individual laborer making a claim with the Bureau of Labor and the contractor's board completely oblivious of that claim. There's no communication.
But it doesn't create the formality of a complaint.
Chair Brown, Representative Esquivel, we regularly work with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and as a matter of fact, sometimes these claims come by way of them. They make the initial determination on the claim, and then they send it over to us. And so it's not as quite, the system doesn't work as well as I'd like, but we generally are aware of if there's a Bureau of Labor and Industries, and so if they've managed to recover some of the money, then of course we would subtract that from any order that we issue. But I don't remember any situation where there's ever been a double recovery on the part of a claimant.
Well, I'm just saying that you could have a contractor over here that's not paying their subs or their laborers, and then that individual could be in the Bureau of Labor, but you wouldn't know it as an organization to put marks and claims against their
There's no requirement that be reported. However, if it is reported, then we can base, we not only can sanction a contractor if they fail to pay one of our orders, but we can sanction a contractor if they fail to pay an administrative order issued by another body, or if they fail to pay a judgment if it arises from a construction contract.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Just to clarify this for my own erudition, under 8.4b, that's what spells out the criteria that would allow someone to be eligible to be waived from this fee. And under C, what you're asking is, if you find that the majority of those that are filing under that are truly indigent or poor and can't afford a $50 fee, which I'm confident there's a lot of folks out there these days, especially, then you would be allowed to make the rule to waive all claimants' $50 fee.
Yes, is that correct? Brown, Representative Schaffler, yes, it would be for that class of claimants.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2073? And none. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2073, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2073.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pitts.
I would move House Bill 2073 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and as courtesy to the chair, I will serve possible notice I may be voting against it on the floor.
Representative Kitts moves we move House Bill 2073 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Currently, as I understand it, laborers that don't have a lot of money can't waive the $50 fee. Is that not correct?
Representative, or Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, yes.
Okay. This would allow for if you find the majority of, just so I clarify, if you find a majority of the folks that file for this aren't, can't afford a $50 fee, you would then just waive fees for all laborers that are filing claims. And in your research, what you've seen so far, there are not great numbers of frivolous claims from labor saying, claiming that they are not being paid by unscrupulous and deadbeat contractors, which there are few in the state of Oregon.
Representative, I'm Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler. There's a yes answer to both of those.
Thank you.
Representative Getz.
Mr. Chair, if in fact what Representative Schaffler just said was true, why in fact does the language say may waive it and not will waive it if the majority of the claimants are found to fall under subsection B?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, that part I think was, the may was inserted there. I don't know whether I did it or whether the drafter from Legislative Counsel's office did it, but I think the idea behind that was to just give a little wiggle room so that we could, you know, I don't know. It's
follow up.
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, I think that part of it was so that we could draft the, we would have a little freedom as to the way that a rule would be drafted, and that there wouldn't be a question later on as to whether the rule was invalid because it somehow didn't meet the requirement of state law.
Follow up.
Certainly.
And if in fact what Mr. Schaffler just said is true, and it is the intention of the board, why does it go on to say the waiver under this paragraph only if, comma, in the opinion of the board, a majority of claimants who file claims based on the furnishings of labor to contractor eligible, etc., etc.? Why not just say if a majority? Why is there an opinion? I mean, either there is a majority. If you have 10 claimants and 6 fall under this, is it the opinion of the board at that point that that is, or is that simply the way it should be? But why is it opinion of the board as opposed to if majority?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, I think that that, I don't know what the thinking was behind that, actually. It's possible that, that when we were drafting this, that we just wanted to make sure that it was clear that it was the board's discretion on this matter, based on how, you know, the evidence of whether these particular class of claimants are, a majority of them are indigent enough so that they would, if they did submit an application, we would okay it, is going to be pretty difficult to come up with. It's, and it's going to be a little bit sketchy, and I think that the language was put in there so that the board would have some discretion based on probably imperfect evidence.
Follow up briefly.
I think what they're saying is they don't require any financial records from them, so they can't prove it one way or another.
Well, according to the Mr. Chair, according to the way that it's written, it says that if under subsection B, which is the previously unchanged subsection right above the changed and added section C, it goes on to specify the application must show the average of monthly income and expenses of the claimant, assets and liabilities of the claimant, and any other information required for the board to rule. So if, in fact, the majority of those claimants that have already gone through it, let me back up, if in the opinion of the board, the majority of those claimants have, in fact, fallen under that, they may then waive it for the future.
Yeah, it's only done if they want the waiver. Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, and maybe this is what you are saying, but they only supply this information if they apply for a waiver. They don't supply it routinely, so the board isn't going to know of all their claimants, the ones that pay the $50, they don't know their financial situation, so it won't be able to be proved. It'll have to be...
Mr. Chair, for clarification, I hope that I'm not a dog wagging his own tail. I don't have any problem with those that come forward and pay the $50. What I have is a deterrent for those that can't afford it, simply to come forward and say, I need a waiver, I can't afford it, but yet I have got to go through the Spanish Inquisition, right, and provide whatever documentation the board may... I mean, they have it pretty well lined out here, everything that's required. you know, your assets, your liabilities, your monthly income, your expenses, and any other information required, which is a huge ambiguity. What does that mean? I mean, why not just provide these documentations? It's like you're going through a mortgage, you know, for a home loan. So I just got a little language, I guess. I understand the intent, and I appreciate the intent, and don't mean to sound adversarial. I'm concerned for those that can't afford it, and for those that, because those people that are working 8 hours a day for minimum wage that aren't making $50 an hour, I think they've got huge pride issues also that shouldn't have to come forward and say, here, and if there's anything else that I can give you, you know, you want my father's, you know, my mother's maiden name, my social security number, what else I can give you, you know, my firstborn, whatever, I mean, and they could, because you could require it right here. You have that ability. So that's where my concern comes for. Thank you.
Chair wants a question too. I just want to commend Mr. Boyd for saying the words, "I don't know." They're not said enough in this building. I want to thank you for that.
I second that.
Is there any other question? Any comments?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts. I might say that what you're talking about is exactly why we are promoting putting this through. We're trying to make it so that, if you want to call it, the board's got the wiggle room to do it, even if we don't have it down to the exact iota that here it all is. And so we're actually on the same page. Maybe we're not reading it from the same place.
We're reading from the same page. We're just reading a little different.
We're reading just, yeah. I mean, you know, like I say, we have a semantical difference, if you really want to call it that. Yes.
Thank you.
Is there any other comment? Seeing none, Katie, will you call it all?
Representative Shostak.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. And motion carries. Representative Schaffler, would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
I'd be happy to. Can we put it on the consent calendar?
I don't think so.
I would object. I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair, either way.
Thank you, Representative.
I'm going to have a few questions.
Mr. Chair, I'm a laborer. I'm used to doing the dirty work.
Let's see, we're down to open the public hearing in House Bill 2074. And did we do 2074? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did first, didn't we? Well, we close the hearing on House Bill 2074 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2078. And, gentlemen.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Craig Smith for the record. We had the last session, we put some requirements on the dispute resolution program that helped reduce frivolous claims. Those requirements included a notice. So the person filing the claim against the contractor had to write a letter to the contractor saying, look, if you don't fix it, I'm going to be putting a black mark on your record by filing a claim. That seems like a real good idea. And we have a lot of anecdotal evidence and some scientific evidence to suggest that that notice requirement alone has helped reduce frivolous claims and also kept matters out of the state dispute resolution process that didn't really need to be, because by writing that letter alone, the contractor and the consumer got together and solved the problem without the state getting involved. So we think that notice really helped. In addition, the $50 processing fee, I think, put a price tag on frivolous claims, so matters that really didn't belong here, that were just made for spite, would cost somebody $50, and you know, you put a price tag on it. Nevertheless, we've discovered, after having some experience, that there's a little bit of a problem. We need it tweaked a little bit. Bill's going to talk about that. This doesn't remove any kind of notice requirement. It doesn't remove the fee. But there's a little problem that developed that we believe caused some consumers to be able to use our dispute resolution program not to be able to get to the surety bond when they really ought to have been able to. Bill will explain that.
The problem was, and I was the one that initially drafted in legislative council, then reworked that draft of that notice requirement. And in my naivety, I thought that, gee, it shouldn't be too complicated. All you have to do is send a certified letter to the contractor using their address of record for the state of construction contractors board keeps. That isn't that difficult. So we drafted exactly that requirement into the law. And then I discovered that Oregonians are very creative in the ways that they give notice, and they give notice in all sorts of different ways that, in fact, did not comply with the law. They send it. They, for instance, a person knows that the address, maybe he doesn't even look up the address of the record, or maybe he does, but he knows that this contractor is operating out of some office on Main Street, and so he sends it to the Main Street address, and we have our official address is on Elm Street, so that person hasn't complied. A person knows that the contractor has already sued them for payment, and that this claim is just a counterclaim to that, and they're wondering, why should I have to send notice? It's a contractor knows that we're having a dispute, and, you know, he's already sued me. There's all sorts of different situations that have come up since then, which have educated me to not assume that things are as simple as they look. And so what this law does is it allows the board to waive the notice requirement or not require the pre-claim notice if the contractor has actual notice. And we would not do this. We would require that there be some actual written notice, you know, for instance, a prior lawsuit, or in some cases we've had the person sent the letter to the contractor, and the contractor sent a letter back indicating they'd received the notice. We've had situations where the person sent a notice with return receipt requested, and they got back the return receipt requested. But the problem was they sent it to the address that they knew that the contractor was at, and it was not the address of record. So this allows us, to where the contractor has actual notice, to go ahead and accept that notice in lieu of the notice that's technically required by the law, and gives us a little more freedom. And because it's tremendously frustrating to claimants, they send the notice and then they file their claim with us, and then we have to write them back and say, well, sorry, that notice was no good, you're going to have to do it all over again. In a few cases, we've had to tell them, sorry, that notice was no good, and it's too late for you to redo it, because you're past the period, the time limitation for filing the claim. So this corrects that. It's going to relieve a lot of frustration on the part of claimants. And you know, I think one of the things that happens is a claimant caught in this sort of catch-22 situation thinks that the state is a bunch of idiots. And we'd like to at least remove one reason for people to feel that. So.
Well, that makes me feel
good. Chair, on that note,
Representative John.
Now, that's the kind of language that we need in here to explain things. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Is there any questions? All right, you other guys, you're shaking the head, no testimony. Okay. Some same questions. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2078? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2078 and open the work session on House Bill 2078. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 2078 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2078 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? We're out on the last one. Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Gilman.
Aye.
Okay.
Representative Gilman.
Wait a minute here.
No, wait a minute. Where did we start?
With Shields.
Oh, okay. All right.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitt.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Escobar votes aye.
That's correct.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we place 2078 on the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves we place 2078 on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's placed on the consent calendar. I think, Katie, I apologize. I think I'm the one to get you all screwed up on that. Let's see.
I just didn't want Representative Gilman speaking for me.
Okay, is there any other...
I have one comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. You know, it's just refreshing to hear so many of my colleagues on this committee so concerned about labor in Oregon. I just wanted to make that comment, and I hope that spirit continues.
Thank you, Representative Slaughter.
You're welcome.
This shows that we're open.
Amen, bro.
Representative Slaughter.
I would like to add, Representative Chaffler, that we know that you're eligible now to have the $50 waiver taken away.
Thank God.
Because we know what you make on a monthly basis.
Janet, do you have any?
I know what his wife makes, so he's not
I won't.
After he shows that Dallas has some liabilities.
Mr. Chair, Wednesday there's six bills on the agenda. We've determined they're pretty straightforward and not huge deals, so that's why we put so many on. If they were very big deals, we wouldn't put quite so many on. And that may be the end of the easy bills. I don't know.
Keep the easy
Thank
bills
you.
Coming.
Just for the CCB, I would like to see two things. Hopefully in the future if you could draft and be the leader in this, and that is a continuing ed thing. I think that's very, very important, not only to the consumer, but to you as an organization as well as the state of Oregon. The other thing I'd like to see us initiate, if you could, and look into, was licensing in the state of Oregon and checking licenses in other states. We have people coming from this state that have lost license in other states, and we're not checking to see what their status is, where they come from. Some states, I understand, do not have licensing, but I do know of one contractor in Southern Oregon that came from two states that did have licensing, and he lost his license in both those states, but he received one in the state of Oregon. So if we could get a checks and balance, I'd really appreciate it.
And I want to thank you, gentlemen, for all the input, all the testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeff, Your Honor.
And if anything else, if not, we are adjourned.
Yes. Thank you.